Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to be talking, of course, we'll be talking about the continued illegal and genocidal bombing of Gaza. The government of South Africa is taking Israel to the world court. This is getting to be a heavy argument. And the demonstrations around the world are steady and really quite inspiring. So we'll talk further about that later on. But our guest today is Robin Philpott. He's the publisher of Baraka Books, and of course has been engaged with the issue of the Palestinians for many, many years. Robin, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Phil. And it's good to be on the program this beginning of the new year.
Yes.
Beginning of the new year. It's great to be on the program.
Yeah, it's by the way, I should just say, my understanding is there's going to be a demonstration in Ottawa, people come from all over the country in January. I urge listeners to check that out. Now, of course, Robin, we're very interested to know because things that happen in Quebec and Montreal are underreported here. So we're always glad to talk to you about this. Demonstrations in Toronto have been continuing on a regular basis and with high-spirited, good numbers. What is the situation in Quebec?
I would say it's very comparable. It's a similar thing. It's been going on for 12 or 13 weeks, demonstrations every week. And as far as I know, there's one this weekend. With sizes going up to 50,000 or more, but continually at least 3,000 people every week, even in when it gets cold, even if we got close to Christmas, people showed up. And there's been a number of other kinds of activities, like they blocked one of the major bridges into Montreal, the Jacques Cartier Bridge, at one point. They had demonstrations on the Boxing Day at one of the big shopping centers just this week. So it's been very militant. There's been a lot of students involved at the Université du Québec à Montréal, at Concordia, at McGill. The students have been very active. And so you can't avoid the question. Somebody who wants to avoid the question is going to have trouble because it's just present, you know.
Yeah. One phenomenon we have here that we're very, well, I should say actually across North America and Europe too, there has been a really outstanding presence of Jewish Canadians, Americans, and others who are condemning the bombing of Gaza and calling for the recognition of the Palestinian state, the two-state solution, some call it, but speaking out in a leading way in demonstrations here. What is that true in Quebec?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's one of the organizations is called Independent Jewish Voices. And they're very active here. At almost every demonstration, they've had people speaking and speaking in French about their defense of Palestine, their opposition to Zionism and to what Israel is doing. And in addition to that, we had a large number of Orthodox Jews marching in the demonstrations and often speaking at the events. And then there was the Independent Jewish Voices held a press conference with two members of the National Assembly here, the elected members, calling for immediate ceasefire. That's a month and a half ago, way before it was. And the Independent Jewish Voices and a Palestinian member of the Quebec National Assembly led that call, and they called for people to demonstrate. So it really tells the story of attacking Israel and comparing it to anti-Semitism. That story is just it's got no legs, even though they keep repeating it.
Yeah, it is really, testimony to the health, the political health and integrity of these initiatives led by the Palestinian Youth Movement. They really understand that this is a political issue and that it's already in formulas for solving this in a political way, not a violent way. And it's just great, in my opinion, that we truly have had what you could call a multicultural response.
Absolutely. Another place where there have been regular demonstrations, and I can't guarantee that it was every week, is Quebec City, where they had good size militant demonstrations in support of Palestine. So, and they're not reported on. We hear about them, but they're not reported on outside of Quebec. But they've been out there regularly. Uh-huh. And the trade unions, of course, have come out with very good statements, Quebec trade union movement.
Now that, again, is very striking, and I want to underline that with you, because, you know, the fact is that some years back, generation, I guess, a decision was finally made to respect the fact that Quebec is a nation and that it has an independent presence in the Canadian labor movement. There's a great working relationship. But one of the things that marks it at the moment is that the leaders of the Quebec National Labor Movement, which is part of the Canadian Labor Congress, the Quebec wing has made a physical leadership presence saying they support the calling for a permanent ceasefire and a political solution in Gaza. That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is. And they've been strong. They've been consistent with the, as you've talked about a generation, with the earlier generation of support for Palestine. The current government has been very bad about the question, very short-sighted and pro-Israel, but the opposition parties, including the Quebec Liberal Party, believe it or not, because it's not the Canadian Liberal Party, it's the Quebec Liberal Party, and the Parti Québécois and the Québec Solidaire, as they say, QS, they all voted for an immediate ceasefire for now, since mid-November. So in other words, the current government is out of step. And I know you wanted to ask about that, but this is an example about the negotiated agreement in the public sector and the trade union movement. But the Quebec current government is out of step on Palestine, as it is on the whole situation of workers mainly in the public sector, hospital workers, teachers, school system, and so on. So it's a combination of, I would say, like the right-wing policies.
Yeah. I want to ask you more about the labor movement. But before I do say, I just make a simple statement that the QFL and the old, what I call CSN, have done this and stood up. But it's very interesting little secret that the Canadian Labor Congress has actually said nothing. And I think we should be looking at their close friend, the AFL-CIO in the United States, who also has managed to say nothing, despite the fact that labor itself, the movements across the country, are speaking out. So it's an interesting political problem. But I want to ask Robin, Quebec has really been the center in recent weeks and days, the focus of Labor's attention in the country has been on what is going on there. So what can you tell us about the developments of the all these strikes and the difficulties they've had with the government?
Okay, there's a common front of public sector workers that includes about 60% of teachers as well. And it's public sector from everything, nurses, orderlies, everybody in the public sector, which works out to something like 400,000, 500,000 people. They voted, and this is the common front. It's the first time in about 50 years. And people with a longer memory remember that the common front, there was a massive general strike back in the 70s, and the leaders, union leaders, were sent to prison. Now, this time, there was a vote for a general strike in early November. And they got this really high percentage in the votes, 95% in favor of general strike. The teachers, it's interesting because during the pandemic, everybody said how important the nurses were, how important the hospital workers were. And then right after, the inflation's gone wild. And they're saying, well, listen, we're getting poorer and the conditions are getting worse. And, in both the public sector health and so on and the education sector. So they started the strike. They had first with 2 days of strike and then another 4 days of strike, the general of the whole common front. And then the teachers in Montreal and Quebec City went on general strike from November 23rd on. So the kids were not at school for a month. And the government, François Legault, the premier, he was really trying to break the unions. You could tell it because he made a lot of public statements. But the public support, so then the common front, they went out for another 8 days. And they were going to go out permanently, like a full unlimited general strike as of January 1st or January 5th or something. And the government tried, and this was, they were trying to negotiate over the heads of the union to get the unionized people and the population against them. And it didn't work. It didn't work. The polls showed that 65% of Quebec population backed the unions. They backed the teachers, they backed the nurses, and the general public sector workers. So they had these big demonstrations. I mean, you're talking about 100,000 people and more. And then they had one we read to last week, where they got a lot of singers and other artists out, calling for defense of the public school system, and very, very militant, very big demonstration. So the kids had been out of school for a month. But then the people would organize and give them support. And there was really, really a real change. And so the government just at a certain point decided it had to reach an agreement because it was losing ground. And the polls also show that the current government and the premier are way down in the polls. They're behind everybody. They're behind the PQ. They're behind, like, it just went a downfall. And the premier became the least popular premier in Canada. And so what they decided, what my theory and the theory of several other commentators, people who watch it, they say, they decided they had to get this thing behind them. And so they reached an agreement yesterday, okay, a full agreement. Everybody's going to go back to work. People predict that the agreement will be ratified, but the strike has been declared over now. The theory is that the government decided that they backed down because the popular support and because the militants, how militant the trade unions were. And so it's a big change because, there's a kind of cynicism had set in on on trade union militant activist work. You know, it may be the same in Ontario, probably, but the cynicism had set in the last 10, 15 years, and it seems to be turned around now. So it's very encouraging. I'll tell you, just in my family, there's members, and they're all happy that they, that it was a very exciting period, and it's been successful. So,
you know, it's interesting. It's one of those things they talk about. Of course, the old language, the ancient language, was that it's hubris that brings down leaders. And there is a story, I mean, a theory about Legault, that he really began to read the press clippings about how smart he was and how everybody loved him. And he actually overplayed it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what he realized, that this is the worst year he'd ever had. And he's got to get it back. So what he did is he opened up the purse string. He detached the purse strings, and they say that he granted things that he had no intention of granting. His goal essentially was to break the unions in the public sector, like by weakening them. He called for flexibility, which meant basically denying seniority rights, that kind of thing. And he said, we want to serve the people, but it didn't work. It backfired on him.
What do you suppose now? You pointed out something, and it is, people should really note it, because I can recall that some years back, people said, well, it's over for the PQ. I mean, they're barely breathing. And now you say they're ahead of Legault.
Yeah, they are leading the polls.
You think they will maintain that? Or you think the fact that he screwed up, will that haunt him and keep him down, or is he's going to bounce back?
Well, he thinks he's going to bounce back. He says Quebecers don't like him anymore. But the PQ, since they won a by-election, hands down, in the end of October, they are now, have led the polls, like led them comfortably for 2 months now, the PQ, with only four members of the National Assembly. They've only got four elected members. But the leader, and it's the end of the year, people are saying, what did it? And people are saying it was when he refused the oath to the king. The way he handled that was just last year at this time.
That's right. There was a crisis. People said he wasn't going to be able to serve. It was a suicide mission,
And now the government, they ended up passing a law, I think it's a bylaw, saying that it was not compulsory to make an oath to the king. And it was the leader of the PQ who did that. So,
he end up liberating all Canadians when people say, well, why can't we do that?
Yeah, exactly. So the question is, will he be able to? My feeling is because he will have to work with the other party, in my opinion. But the fact is that the current government, the way it handled the public sector strike, people are not going to forget. Even if he ended up granting them things, he left the kids out of school for a month. People are mad about that, and there was strike in the public sector in the hospitals, and they kept complaining. And he just was hoping that he could get the population against the unions and get unionized people against their leaders. And it didn't work at all. So my feeling is that he's going to drag this for quite a while.
Well, it's a very, really important story. We're glad we have you, by the way, talking on the Taylor Report, because frankly, we do not get the discussion here. As you know, I think half the population of English speaking Canada thinks that Quebec is somewhere southeast of Albania. And it's not their fault. They're simply not informed. Lastly, before I let you go on this kind of on the political subject there, I want to mention you have an NDP member who really made his mark with a great petition. Who is he, and how's his initiative going?
His name is Alexandre Boularis. He's a Montreal, elected here in Montreal, in the Montreal North Central part of the city, a riding. He was elected with Jack Layton in 2011. He came from, he and his family were people who were sovereigntists in their background. You know, that's where they politically came from and around the, you know, the whole coalition that was back in the 90s. Now, he's been very consistent. And from the beginning, people have said he was the most significant MP in the NDP here from Quebec.
That petition was huge.
Yeah, and he got that petition. I can't remember the wording, but it came out around the end of November.
Didn't he get 250,000 signatures?
Yeah, the biggest in the history. The biggest. Oh. Yeah, and so he's forced a lot of people who were trying to fence it to take a position. In fact, he forced the Bloc. In my opinion, it was his work that forced the Bloc Québécois to stop sitting on a fence and to come out in favor of the ceasefire, because they were trying to be sort of finesse things, you know.
Thinking it would blow over.
Yeah, and I think he gained a lot of respect for his consistent position on that, and we'll see how that carries out in the coming year. But
I hope people here will follow him and keep track, because it's courage in politics is quite rare. And when you have outstanding people and they get support, I mean, the more that's heard about it, the better, in my opinion. I'm really glad you could help us with that. I've got to remind everyone that Robin Philpott, the publisher of a really important publishing house, Baraka Books, and they've won some big prizes. A couple of 3 years back, you actually won one of the biggest literary prizes there is.
Well, we were finalists for the Giller.
Pardon me?
We had a book that was a finalist for the Giller Award.
Yes.
And I was very glad to see this Palestinian movement go in and tell the Giller people what they thought.
Yeah.
Because they had the Palestine. You can't do these things without holding people, telling people, you know, this is happening in Palestine, you know.
Yeah. So now you have a book coming out in February by Eve Engler, quite well known to the Tater Report listeners, and well known particularly in English Canada for his history books, progressive history accounts, challenging imperialism, colonialism. Actually, I think that they really are comparable to the American historian, which has become a beloved figure. He's passed away now, but I'm sorry to say, I can't say his name off the top of my head, but who wrote People's History. And Eve has been doing this for quite a while now, and you're publishing a book by him. Talk about that book.
Yeah, it's a book that's coming out in February. It's called Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. And it's got an epigraph where it says, why has there never been a coup in Canada? And the answer is because there's no Canadian embassy in Canada, so it's a co-authored, by the way, by Owen Schock, who lives in Manitoba, and he writes for the Canadian Dimension, a young journalist, very good journalist. He's got good pieces in, among other things, in the Canadian Dimension, and they go over all the major coups that have gone on, that have been taken place since the 1950s, and the role Canada played. And it's It's Iran in 53, Colombia in 53, Guatemala, Dominican Republic, Indonesia, Brazil.
Throw a dart at a map.
Yeah. And Ukraine, Palestine in 2006, and how Canada played a role, sometimes backroom role, sometimes out front. But there were, you know, it has played this role as a power, but not a real power, but a facilitator of some of the worst coup d'etat that there have taken place in the last, since the Second World War. And
Look at Bolivia, quite recently, there was, and the successful right-wing coup in Peru.
Right.
Where Canada just stood by and smiled.
Yeah, and what they've got is they showed how they actually helped. Yeah. That's one of the things that Eve does this kind of work. He follows them very closely. He follows very closely what the prime minister is saying, what his ministers are saying. You know, he keeps himself subscribed to everything that comes out officially. So he's it's a great collection of small histories. Haiti, that's one of the areas where Eve is very strong, and it has points out all the role that Canada has played.
By the way, some of Eve's best work has been on Haiti. He's really had a good focus. He actually was ahead of the wave when Canada organized that meeting to overthrow whichever president it was.
It was Aristide. Yeah, it was in 2004, and it's going to be a very useful handbook for politically active people to know how Canada has behaved in the past, Venezuela, Peru, Bolivia, you name it. And they've been very involved in all these coups, Chile in 73. But here that's one of the things that's very useful for Canadian activists. It will be very useful to know these histories and to observe how Canada operates.
Yeah.
You know, and the actual void in their official speech, which is, you know, we're here for democracy. That's just hogwash, and they make it very clear, and they've done a good job.
Nicely, doesn't it, with your Quebec liberal, PQ person who refused to swear oath to the king.
Yeah.
Because that little link explains Canadian behavior. It's an empire, part of the empire.
There you go. Exactly. It's part of an empire, and it plays a more, up until the Second World War, it was the British, and they would call on some Canadians. After the Second World War, Canada started operating much more independently of the British, but in fact, they were facilitators largely for the U.S. And the interesting thing about this book is that there have not been a lot about how Canada operates on the international scene. There hasn't been much written about it in the last, you know, since the Second World War. And so that's one thing. It's going to fill a vacuum, I would say, in political debate on Canada. I mean, each one of these stories would require books, but they've been over all the material that exists, and they present it in a very, very readable manner. So we're looking forward to it. It's already up for pre-order if people want to get it, you know.
He's had some these themes that he's worked, and of course one leads to the other. Even when Canada is playing the more passive role, Eve is one of those who points out that, for example, in the days of the United Nations, when Lester Pearson was the hero, actually it was a, the role was a reactionary role.
Yeah.
To guarantee the best interests of the U.S. and the U.K.
Yeah.
And Eve has taken that up.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. He's taken up, and he you know, and I think it'll help people dismantle their official discourse now. When you read this, in other words, it helps you look what to look out for when you see Canada doing something. You know, that's one of the good aspects of this book.
Yeah, yeah. I hope. By the way, I was reminded by a labor historian that it was the Howard Zinn. This fellow and Eve does resemble Howard Zinn in many ways. I think we ought to encourage him to take it on a people's history.
Yeah, it is.
He and his fellow writers there at the magazine is
at the Canadian Dimension, but it's
Canadian Dimension.
He's
the ideal people to try it. I incidentally, it's not a rich field. I think we're very fortunate that such writers exist, but it's not as though we have dozens.
No.
And we really need to create a kind of a culture of, why don't we have a people's history approach to all, you know, every aspect of our economy, culture, politics.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think Howard Zinn is a wonderful figure, but I think he needed help, frankly. And I think Eve is another guy working on the frontier who needs help. I mean, we need a lot of people should contribute and work off the themes that he's developing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, it's true, because, you know, the Canada gets it sits back as if it has no colonial history. You know, Canadians like to say, well, we have no colonial history, which is totally false. Totally false. And and so that's one of the things that Eve goes after, you know.
And Baraka Book has tackled this subject more than once, that's really to your credit. Tell us again, so the title of the book is, and when is it coming out, and how can people get the book?
It's called Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. It's coming out in February. You can buy it on our website. You can pre-order on the website or on Amazon or whatever. And so I think it'll be a great contribution as, you know, the politics are becoming more militant with what happened with the attack on Gaza and Palestine. People are becoming more militant, which I think we can all observe that.
The scales are falling from their eyes, isn't that? People's eyes are opening.
Yes, exactly. And so a book like this will help them realize that it's not just, you know, that Canada's done this. People have these ideas about Canada, that Canada's such a great, a good force in international politics. And this one points out, be careful.
Yeah. Well, Robin, it's been great talking to you. This is, and it's great. It's exciting that there's a very timely book coming out from Baraka Books. And I think we all take heart approaching the new year with it. There seems to be widespread popular movements, and in Canada and Quebec again. So,
sure. Exactly.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
And thanks for inviting me
again.
Happy New Year to everybody.
All right.
Okay, bye. Thanks.
This is Taylor Report. We're going to take a break and come back in a moment. And welcome back. It is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. And we have these matters. We want to stay on these themes. We're very glad we had the talk with Robin Philpott and hearing about Eve Engler. And of course, we're celebrating the fact that there is a widespread international movement, particularly strong in we call the Global South. Canada's, what is it? We the North. That's too bad. Canada should be connecting to all the movements and all the countries of the earth who are already way ahead of us. I said on the program, it seems like a shocking piece of information, I'll repeat it. More countries recognize the state of Palestine than recognize Israel. I only raise that because there is an opportunity at all times to have a peaceful political settlement, long since existing formulas, but it takes activity and demonstrations and unfortunately a bloody tragedy, a horrible tragedy such as that is unfolding in Gaza, to remind Canadians and Americans and all others that the solution is there to be done. Biggest obstacle is Washington. And there is a phenomenon in Canada, and you'll see it in editorial writing at the Globe, the Star, the National Post, Toronto Sun. And that is, I call it mad realism. They say you have to be realistic. You have to do what America does because they're a giant. We are adjacent to the giant, a long, now protected border. And it's always argued that, okay, at the end of the day, you do what they tell you. And that is mad realism. That's a form of insanity because you have surrendered agency to whoever it is that's running Washington. I don't claim to know. There's people called the deep state. There's people called the Republicans. There's people called the Democrats. There's the State Department, the Pentagon, the CIA. They all seem to be pretty strong. And when the Republicans come and the Republicans go, Biden comes, Trump goes, Biden comes. State Department doesn't change. Pentagon doesn't change. The CIA, they don't change. So it's extremely dangerous that Canada lashes its little wagon to a mad engine of imperialism that says it is an indispensable nation. On the face of it, for Canada to stand by while that is said to them is humiliating and is a betrayal of the interests of the Canadian people, because they didn't say they're an indispensable bi-nation, Canada, US. They said they're an indispensable nation called the US. And you have lovely guys who win Nobel Prizes and look so handsome, stand so tall, and are so eloquent as Barack Obama, when he was president of the United States. He goes in front of the will-be generals of the American Army, West Point, and he says, "I believe in every fiber of my being in American exceptionalism." And that means, by the way, Canada, France, Germany, whoever you happen to be, South Africa, you don't count. You have a thing called the UN Charter, that doesn't count. You have things like international law, that does not count. He said American exceptionalism. So it's a country that is, and he isn't alone. I offer Barack Obama as just a wonderful, smiling, intelligent Harvard man, politician, who, very popular, who says that. and then acts on it, of course. We're not talking about rhetoric. We're talking about agency. Therefore, I'm going to come back to the words. Anybody who says we got to do what they say because they're big is a mad realist, because that exceptionalism, calling yourself indispensable, ties into a word we were using a while ago, speaking to Robin Philpott, of hubris. The Greeks, as you know, had an expression, pride goes before the fall. And there's another one, boys, you ought to remember, that who the gods would destroy, they first make mad. And to call what was formed as a Republican and Democratic society based on the concept that all people were created equal, then says we are exceptional. They've entered a realm of political insanity, madness. It's not many leaders in the world mention it. They talk about it. Of course, the principal individual who's said it a few times is Putin, President Putin of Russia. But because they have a kind of a machine that they throw switches and they can just repeat something over and over, they have demonized their opponents to the extent that when one of them says something, the people are taught to put their hands over their ears and to go, no, 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 no. But it's a simple observation, then made by, of course, other the leaders of South Africa. Nelson Mandela said it. So, by the way, all Canadians think we love, because officially we do love, Nelson Mandela. However, we never pay the slightest attention or respect to anything he said. For example, he supported the two-state solution and befriended the Palestinian people. One reason being that they had befriended him when he was in prison and the Americans were calling him a terrorist, which I remember. But these leaders have said, you can't dictate to us. You can't do it. We too are a people and states, and we have self-respect. And if you continue to interfere with us, of course we will resist you. And that interference, anybody who is thinking about history and watching will tell you that this is a doomed project. No one people are going to get away with saying they're going to dictate it, saying it openly, that they're going to tell other people where to get off. That it's a doomed project. And therefore, I would argue, the Star and the Globe and the National Post are suffering from what they think is realism, but it's insane realism. And you want to remember that the American population itself is very diverse and underrepresented, because America has allowed money to become the arbiter of the so-called democracy that they've constructed. I don't know if, you know, people have forgotten that the Republicans and the Democrats argued this way back, that a corporation is a person. I don't hear that anymore, but because they understand it's, if you keep saying it, whoever says that is going to be stoned by the people. They will be stoned by it, chased down the street. They don't say it so much, but it's still true that they've, because a monopoly capital has taken over the political parties, and they prevent real opposition from ever forming. But it's only by tricks, diversion, and various kinds of stunts that they get away with it. The people remain restless in America, unhappy. You know that the polls show that the vast majority, the majority of the American people want a permanent ceasefire, and they want a political solution recognizing the rights of the Palestinian people. They're not saying they don't recognize the rights of the Israelis, but they're saying they want the Palestinian national sovereignty and statehood, et cetera, clear. American people want that. They have maybe three members of Congress. I don't keep count, but why bother? A handful who express what the majority of Americans want. In the White House, it's what Joe Biden wants. Joe Biden and those who believe in the American exceptionalism and the American empire. We've remarked on it before on the Taylor Report, that you have them, that I believe the world could be burning down. And all that the bosses in the White House would want to know is, if there's a crisis, do they still come to us to solve it, even though it's on fire and is going to burn them down? They want to have, for example, now, last few days, we have a terrible tragedy, unspeakable tragedy. And so the White House invites President Sisi of Egypt and the King of Jordan, pardon me, to come and talk about, or to get together with a lesser light, Mr. Blinken, so that Washington is handling it. And then they have the representative of Qatar. I keep remarking on this because the White House has a game. They say we're fighting Iran. Well, Hamas, the political movement Hamas, has many friends and associates. But the one actually where they spend most of their time is Qatar. And in terms of on the record accounting for billions, those billions came from Qatar. And Qatar is a strategic ally of the United States. So America is having a meeting with itself to show the American people, you see, we have these Arabs here, and we're talking to them. And meanwhile, our Israeli friends are doing what they have to do, and we're not going to stop them. So that's a closed-in world, which they intend to hang on to the last hours. I think I've said as a joke, I think that if and when America were to collapse from its own lies and its own aggression and its own hubris, that whoever conqueror might be who walked into Washington and opened the doors of Congress will find Republicans and Democrats wrestling on the floor and gouging each other's eyes over pieces of the remaining pieces of the pie. So anyway, you're listening to the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. Let us abandon mad realism. Maybe it's magic realism. Mad realism of those who say we have to follow. We actually have to help. And I've said it. I know it sounds repetition, but I have to say it. Repetitious. Now, there is, I can't resist passing on a kind of a joke here. It's published in the Globe and Mail, but it's still a good joke. Writing a very heavy piece, thoughtful piece, Chasen Drum at the Globe and Mail, they own the story of the Chinese interference file, and they own the story on Kovrig and Spavor, the two Michaels who turned out to be one Michael, and now everybody's going to get a payoff, and we live happily ever after. So they wrote a piece about it to show, once again, they're reviewing all the information, and a cowbell dropped into the article, and here's how it reads. Mr. Spavor is one of the few intermediaries who traveled extensively to North Korea, here's the line, and has a personal relationship with the dictator, Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un. Mr. Spavor has been in prison for 2.5, 3 years, you had to remind me. He was charged under suspicion of espionage by the Chinese, the espionage involving information that he may have passed on to Mr. Covery while they were in a cafe on the Yellow River, which is, you know, Canadians hear that one another's in the country, they go and meet in a cafe on the Yellow River. So anyway, so that information had to do with North Korea. And the Globe says he has, present tense, a relationship. That, don't they have editors at the Globe? Wouldn't an editor say, are you sure that's a close relationship? Does he get Christmas cards? Do they call each other? Actually, I think it's entirely anecdotal. He did very famously once get to meet Kim Jong-un, we know, because he knew somebody even more important, a retired National Basketball Association All-Star. And it was because he was able to arrange for the basketball player to visit North Korea that we see Mr. Spavor talking with in the same boat room. But to actually say that he has a relationship, when you're writing a serious article about the problems of Canadian so-called intelligence, by the way, I'm sure that North Korea and China pray that the gentlemen running Canadian intelligence all stay in their posts, because it's a catch and jammer kids meets Keystone Cops. It's a clown show. So it would, North Korea, China must say, please don't change. That you're doing great. You're wonderful. But it just shows, in my mind, how mediocre our coverage is of this. The Toronto Star can't bring itself to cover it because they went so far overboard about how the two Michaels were just wonderful guys. And, of course, we saw them in Parliament. Parliament really ought to avoid meetings where they introduce people who are visiting, because they had the two dubious gentlemen. I would call them dubious only in terms of their personal stories. They're probably very honorable people. And then they had, and that we won't forget it, since this is the end of the beginning of a new year, it was, we had an important visitor at Parliament who turned out to be a Nazi. Not a full-blown one. He was an Untermensch. He wasn't an actual German, but he got to serve him, and he was quite delighted. Anyway, we have problem in Parliament. We have problem in our coverage of these things. There's a story developing in Argentina I want to call everybody's attention to. And that is that a guy with a chainsaw, who's a Trump admirer, has taken over power, Milei, and he has begun to take steps, and I want to call attention to it, that an Argentine labor writer puts it this way. He says, you don't ask for pears from an elm tree. This guy is not, the new government in Argentina seems to be anxious to become a fascist government. They have announced they're not going to allow workers' demonstrations. They're not going to allow picketing. They're going to fine people for having demonstrations. And labor in Argentina is answering, and they say there's going to be a general strike. every Canadian, every American, everybody who understands the dynamics of a free society should be watching Argentina very closely. We've been blessed by having Ms. Farina, an authority on this subject, a couple of times, and we're going to ask her to come back because the general strike is looming. It's clear that this president is looking to establish a type of junta fascist system. Clearly, he's going to violate the constitution of Argentina. He's already doing it. The person who announced it has a wonderful name. Her name is Patricia Bullrich. Bullrich. God makes these funny names up for people. And she has announced that there won't be, picketing will not be allowed. And that youth will not be allowed to come to demonstrations. They will arrest anybody who brings what she calls children to demonstrations in Argentina will be arrested. Therefore, we're in a time zone where it's going to have to be the writer of the article, and I invite you, please start searching, get all you the news you can, because labor is going to fight back. And as they say, they have no choice. They said, see, the reason we have the right, and it's in our constitution, is because when you attack the people and you take the bread off the table, take food away from them, take their old age, their pensions away from them, when you break up their unions so that they can't fight back, they will take to the streets. That's called the right to protest. And it's in the Constitution. Bullrich says that she can do this. This is called, she is what they call a technocrat. She's a political monster. But she's working for Milei, the new president, who says he's a chainsaw. And I think he's right. He's got brains of a chainsaw. But this is nothing to be sneezed at. The Americans are watching with pleasure. They had a coup in Peru and they got away with it. And you can see British warships are showing up off the coast of Venezuela. Imperialists can't help themselves. They're mad, as I said at the beginning, and we have to defeat them and rid ourselves of these mad leaders who only are there because of greed. One small class looking after itself. We have to get rid of them. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. It's been fun. See you next week.